This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today, we have the winner of the National Book Award for Writing in the Arts, the Marfield Award. Wendy Lesser is here from New York and California, and she's going to tell us the name of this book and what it's about.
Thank you, Grace, for having me. I'm honored to be on a program that's mainly devoted to poetry because it's such an important thing.
Well, you're basically in the poetry biz.
Yes, exactly. But in this case, it's a nonfiction book about an architect. It's called You Say to Brick, The Life of Louis Kahn. And it's about an architect who many architects feel is the greatest American architect of the 20th century. But he was not so well known outside of his own field.
And you're helping him to be known outside of his field.
I suppose so. I mean, there's already been a great movie made about him by his son, Nathaniel Kahn, called My Architect.
I want to see that. But I think it's very important for people to know that the Marfield Award is something where publishers every year send piles of books on photography, dance, painting, every form of the arts. And it's very competitive, and you won it.
Yes, and I was thrilled to get the phone call saying I had won it.
Did you have the feeling that this was competitive?
I did, although I didn't know how competitive until I got here and they explained the whole process to me. I knew that there were five of us that were finalists, so I was excited that I beat out the other four, but I didn't know how many, 800 or whatever books
had
gone into
hundreds,
it in the first place.
Hundreds. Yeah. And I do say that the fact that it's an award for writing in the arts is very significant because it's given by the DC Arts Club.
Yes.
And I feel it's equal to the Pulitzer in heft. So here we are with Wendy Lesser, and she has been well known as the founder, and editor of the Three Penny Review, which all of us in literature know about. So I want to talk a little bit about why Louis Kahn, and we have to say it's K-A-H-N, for people who are going to go Google it, why he is listed as one of the world's iconic architects. Why?
Well, of course, the short answer is because the works are good. He had his own way of doing things. He was a modernist who had been trained in classical architecture. In the 20s, he went to architecture school at Penn, and he studied under Beaux-Arts architects. And so that was like old style, fancy symmetry, decoration. But then he got involved with the modernists in the 1930s and 40s, and he was a big admirer of Le Corbusier. So he was a modernist in that period. But then he went to Rome in 1950 as the resident architect at the American Academy in Rome. And seeing Roman architecture and being toured around it by an archaeologist who was there at the time changed his way of designing. So when he got back to America in the early 1950s, he was suddenly a modernist mixed with an ancient classicist. And if you look at his buildings that are the masterpieces that were built from the early 50s onward, they all have a slightly huge, hulking, ancient Roman quality, and with natural light coming in through open windows through the, brick or concrete walls. But they also have a very modern feeling, as if they're built just now. A strange combination of those two things.
I think you make him sound as if he is a normal person who studied architecture and became a brilliant maker of things. However, he was such an unusual artist that we have to put into the mix. I mean, he was so idiosyncratic and believed so much in his vision. He was so unlike your ordinary tradesman in the field. Even his personal life was so interesting that's what makes the book really fun reading.
Yes.
So tell us about how you layered his personal life with his professional life to make it a good read.
Okay. I already knew about the personal life from Nathaniel's movie. This 2003 movie is made by his third child, his son Nathaniel, who was the son of the third woman he was involved with, that is, his wife and two other women.
Out of wedlock. Nathaniel's
out of wedlock. Yeah. Nathaniel's older sister, Alexandra, is out of wedlock. Her mother is Ann Ting, another architect. And then Sue Ann Kahn, the oldest daughter, is the daughter of the official wife, who remained the official wife throughout Louis Kahn's life. That is, all three of these families essentially were simultaneous, even though the children are 10 or 11 years apart. And they all knew about each other in Philadelphia. And this was an oddity that was widely known in Philadelphia, but was kept concealed because it's not the way architects are supposed to behave. Architects are supposed to be like lawyers and judges and important businessmen and have clients and wear suits. And Lou wore a suit with a bow tie, but he otherwise was a rather artistic person. He ran his firm like an artistic studio, and he lived his life like an artist.
I would like you to read a little bit of this book. He knew who he was.
He
knew who he was from the moment he was born. And he said he was an architect, whether he was brushing his teeth or combing his hair. And I believe that is why he could maintain outside relationships with women, because he was with them. He knew who he was.
I think that is part of it. And his terrific intensity is what the women often talk about.
His charisma.
Yeah.
And each one felt that, of course, they had feelings, but they... You lead us to believe that each one felt it was worth being with him because they felt they were the only one in his life when he was with them, even if he had to see the children between 3 and 4 in the morning. I mean, that you make that very vivid, that he is so charismatic that people will accept any terms.
Well, and also that they all believed in his mission, as they put it. That is, the wife and the two other women strongly supported what he was doing in architecture, and they thought that they were helping to contribute to it, as
and
they were.
They certainly were.
Yeah. So shall I read a little bit?
Here's Wendy Lesser, and I want you to know who you're listening to. We told you that she was the founder of the Three Penny Review, the author of one novel and 9 previous books of nonfiction, including Music for Silenced Voices and Why I Read, which has great acclaim from coast to coast. She lives in California and New York. She's written for the New York Times Book Review, the London Review of Books, the Times Literary Supplement. She has commissions for 2 more books after this. One is completely finished, and I am gobsmacked. Here's Wendy Lesser.
All right, here's a bit from near the beginning of the book. Louis Kahn was a warm, captivating man, beloved by students, colleagues, and friends, enduringly attractive to strangers and intimates alike. But he was also a secretive man, hiding under a series of masks. There was the physical mask he wore permanently on his face, a layer of heavy scars produced by a childhood accident. Then there was the mask of conventionality he wore in his private life, the 44-year marriage to Esther Kahn, mother of his oldest daughter and partner in his Philadelphia social life, which covered over his intense romantic liaisons with 2 other women, Anne Ting and Harriet Pattison, each of whom bore him a child outside of wedlock. There was also his name, which was not really his name at all, but a convenient invention devised by Kahn's father and subsequently imposed on his whole family when they immigrated to America. The boy who had been born Lieser Itza Shmulovsky in Estonia became Louis Isidore Kahn in America. Not an escape from Jewish identity itself, but a purposeful elevation from the lowly Eastern European category to the more respectable and established ranks of German Jews. And even Jewishness for Kahn may have been another kind of mask, defining him in the eyes of WASP Philadelphia, not to mention the echt Protestant architecture world, but less fully defining him to himself. If he received more commissions to build synagogues than churches or mosques, it is nonetheless the case that among his built masterpieces, only a mosque in Dhaka's parliament building and a church, First Unitarian in Rochester, emerged triumphant. The synagogues, for the most part, foundered in the design phase. "I'm too religious to be religious," he once told a friend after a major Philadelphia synagogue commission had disappointingly died on the drafting board following years of conflict with and within the congregation.
I'm glad you brought that up, because what astonished me more than anything else was, you know, you see this rise to fame, you do not realize the failures. He would spend 3 years in Israel or someplace working on a design, and it would collapse and he'd get no money from it. He would have so many partially fulfilled projects that somebody would pull the rug out of. He needed the money from his wife. And this book tells us more about what fame is really like without money.
in his case. I think that there are famous architects who earn money, but Lou was a terrible businessman. He died $500,000 in debt. So he was terrible at making money. And it's true that Esther, his wife, who worked steadily throughout all the years of their marriage, was the major breadwinner until he was nearly 50. They already had a child by that time. In fact, he had a second child with somebody else by that time. And yet she was bringing in the bulk of the income.
And then he taught as well, which helped. And I bet he was one heck of a teacher, though, because he was just so visionary. And then he would just live in this bubble of vision. Yes. So I recommend this book. It is called You Say to Brick. And Wendy Lesser is our award-winning writer, Marfield Award for Writing in the Arts. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. I have to say, I know the difference between cement and concrete now.
And yes, I learned it too in the course of writing this book.
And think about the materials.
Yes.
Weren't they fascinating, the way he used them? But I have to say, my favorite part of the book was the Trenton bathhouse, which is referred to many times as one of his first great structures. I'm from Trenton. I immediately sent my friends out to scout for it. Is it still existing?
It is. And in fact, the second passage that I chose to read is about the Trenton bathhouse. And it was a ruin for a number of years. If you see Nathaniel's movie in the years that he took it, it was a ruin, but it was restored. And now it's functioning as a bathhouse, a changing room, essentially, to go to the pool at the...
He was so proud of this little house because it spoke of his elements, even more than the Salk Institute, you know, more the Yale British Museum for the Arts, British Art. I mean, all of these great things he did, but the Trenton bathhouse keeps coming up.
Yes. Well, it was the first building he did that used his new vision of what architecture should be. He got back from Rome, and he designed the Yale Art Gallery, which is the beginning of his mature career, but only has a few elements that remind us of his greatest works. And then he did something called the Richards Building at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, which is a tall skyscraper, sort of glass and brick, biological studies building. And that is an icon of modernism, and the Museum of Modern Art celebrated it as a great building. But Lou thought that the Trenton bathhouse, which he did a few years before the Richards building, was more indicative of the path he was going to take than the Richards building. Should I read that little bit?
Please.
Yeah. If the world discovered me after I designed the Richards Tower building, he told an interviewer many years later, I discovered myself after designing that little concrete bathhouse in Trenton. In this judgment, he was to prove singularly correct. It was the Trenton bathhouse, begun 3 years before the Richards building, that more accurately forecast the remarkable buildings of his later years. Something about that modest yet precise structure, it turned out, was capable of giving its users the same kinds of pleasures that would be generated by his masterpieces. A sense of being safely enclosed while at the same time gaining access to the world outside, a delight in the various forms of natural illumination, which changed according to the time of day, a tactile appreciation of sturdy materials like unpainted wood and rough concrete, and a feeling of grandeur even in the most quotidian of circumstances. Picture a girl from nearby Trenton, an adolescent, say, just a year or two younger than Kahn's oldest daughter, who might have come to the bathhouse for a short swim soon after it opened to the public. After passing by the front wall's mural and reaching the central courtyard, she goes left to get into the women's changing room. Slipping through one of the twisty, doorless concrete entrances that lead in from either side, she finds herself released into the surprisingly grand space of the room itself, all the larger in comparison to the tunnel-like approach. Above her, the high arch of the pyramidal wooden roof guides her eye upward to the square hole from which light pours down, making everything, even her own body, seem to bask in the ceiling's glory. At one side of the room, a 5-foot space between the roof and the wall, one of Kahn's earliest and largest light joints, allows the sun to shine directly on her shoulders as she sits on the changing room bench. Looking around, she notices how lightly the massive pyramid rests on its 4-corner supports, so that the ceiling almost seems to float above her head. Even the construction materials, the coarse wood and the undisguised concrete blocks, take on a kind of rough sublimity from their placement in this setting, as if to suggest that humble things could have their own form of elegance. Mm. As the girl sits in the light and watches it alter over time, with clouds passing over the sun and the sun itself slowly shifting position, she might well take this message about transcendence to apply directly to herself.
So these small edifices where light streams in, they're his signature, and wood, brick, concrete, and steel. I have a new respect for beveled brick edges. He would make brick, you tell us, he would make it a certain way so that the edges would fit differently from other bricks.
That was in India, and he responded to each place he built and designed the materials there according to what the local system and building processes required. So when he was building in Exeter, New Hampshire, for instance, where he built the Phillips Exeter Library, he just ordered the bricks from a nearby brickyard. Mm-hmm. He ordered all the bricks at once so they would all be the same color, but he didn't say they need to be like designed like this. But when he was in India, where the people were actually putting together the bricks into a wall in the way that they did with their own local crafts, he would show them how he wanted the edges shaped and how he wanted the mortar put in between, which was different from how they usually did it. And they have, at the Indian Institute of Management, which he designed and supervised the building of, they have some model arches and model small walls that he built to show the workers how to do it. And they're still standing there. If you go to the Indian Institute of Management, in a corner of the garden are the samples that Louis Kahn built to show the workers how to...
You went. Wendy Lesser is the Marfield winner of this year's prize on writing in the arts given by the DC Arts Club. He had a few failures that are still pretty public, and one, you say, was the cafeteria at Exeter, which looks like a crematorium.
The students call it the crematorium. It has chimneys coming out of it.
But, you know, that must be very alarming for an architect to have things that are so visible that are unappreciated. I mean, we can put our writing in a drawer, right? I wondered how Wendy Lesser got triggered and fell in love with the subject of Louis Kahn.
It was the latest building of his to be constructed, which was built nearly 40 years after his death, the FDR Four Freedoms Monument and Park that's on Roosevelt Island in New York. And shortly after it opened to the public, which was in 2012, I wanted to take a walk on Roosevelt Island, and I took the tram over there. It's an air tram. It flies through the air over the East River and lands on Roosevelt Island. And I walked south, and there was this newly opened park and monument. And I already knew about Louis Kahn at that point from Nathaniel's movie, but I didn't really think anything of him in terms of my own writing. But when I got to this park, the park itself designed by Harriet Pattison, and then the building that is the monument to FDR designed by Lou, it's a wonderful space. You arrive at it from this long approach, and you end up looking out at the East River, Manhattan on one side, Brooklyn and Queens on the other, and you have this feeling of being simultaneously enclosed and set free. And then there are these great quotes from FDR's Four Freedoms speech on a granite wall behind you. And I just thought, okay, I get this. I get what he is saying to the person who comes to this spot. He's communicating in a way other than with words. He's communicating with built materials, but they say something to me. And so I already knew that he had an interesting life, and I thought I could write about this guy.
What do you think of this comment? He says, Louis Kahn, and we have to say K-A-H-N, "No space was a space that does not show how it was made."
That is very much his ethic of his mature work. That is, he wants you to see in the concrete the places where it was held in the plywood forms and where the concrete was against the wood and where it was holes were made by the strings that tied the wood together.
That's so interesting, because in our craft and writing, we would like just the finished piece. But in architecture, did he introduce that idea of the visible connections?
In some ways, that is, it must have been implied before in certain of the buildings he admired. But finished architecture that looked perfect was very much the ideal that he was trained in. There was another kind of architecture going on at the time he was young, and he was associated with these architects. They're called brutalists, and they were trying to make things looked like concrete that were concrete and so forth. And
Le Corbusier, but he didn't like the exposed pipes and all of those things.
You know, he hates pipes, he said. He was always trying to hide pipes. That was not the level of his own architecture's self-manifestation. He was more interested in having people feel that a human hand had been involved in these things that were made of modern materials.
I like that.
And so you would see texture and you would see a sense of the meeting points between things. He was famous for leaving a little gap between concrete and wood, or wood and travertine, so that they each had their own distinct element.
What is travertine?
Travertine is a kind of
marble, is
Italian marble, and the entire plaza of the Salk Institute, which is one of the most beautiful spaces in the Western Hemisphere, is paved in pale travertine. And at the time, the guy who worked with Louis Kahn on that building was telling me about it. He said, well, we knew that there was going to be a plaza, and it faces toward the Pacific Ocean, and it's got concrete buildings on either side. But it took him a while to figure out how he was going to pave it. And he thought of this rock, and he thought of that rock, and none of these were available. And then it turned out that he could get Italian travertine. And he said, we had the largest shipment of Italian travertine ever to arrive in America at that point, and it cost less than vinyl tile. So that was pretty great.
And think of doing all this on credit. Always.
The Salk Institute was his only profitable project.
That is something to think about. Yeah. Wendy Lesser has given us a lot to think about, but I'm all very interested in the process. So after you were enlightened by what you saw in Roosevelt Island. Is it Roosevelt Island?
Mm-hmm.
A whole island? And then you went to a publisher and said, I have an idea?
No, my previous publisher, my editor has already edited four books of mine. Ever since the previous biography I'd written, which was a biography of Shostakovich, the Russian composer, she had been agitating for me to do another biography. And I had been resisting because it was very, very hard to write about Shostakovich. So I had said to her, I'm never writing another biography. But when I saw the Louis Kahn monument, I realized, okay, I could write a biography.
What did you do to begin? What is the first thing you do?
Probably the first thing you always do if you're researching a subject that you don't know a whole lot about, and in my case, since I'm not an architect, I didn't, is read other people's books. So I read all the things that were easily available that I could get quickly about Louis Kahn. And then almost immediately, I got in touch with the Architectural Archives at Penn, which is where all his papers went, and all 6,000 of his drawings, and many other things, including the suitcase he was carrying when he died, and many answers to mysteries that I was able to solve while I was writing the book. And I also got in touch with his three children, Nathaniel Kahn, Alexandra Ting, and Sue Ann Kahn. And I wrote to them, and I said, I want to write a book about your father. Here's what I am planning to say. Here's how I'm planning to do it. Would you be willing to speak with me? And they all wrote back and said yes. And through them, I then was introduced to quite a few other people, his other relatives, the people who had worked with him, people who had used his buildings. And at the same time, I started traveling to the buildings. So there might be a few. I never got to Fort Wayne, Indiana, where he has a performing arts center, and that's a pretty major building of his. But other than that, I went to see all of his major buildings in America that are still standing, that are not changed or
some
knocked
have
down.
Been changed.
Some have been altered and some have been knocked down. And then I went to the two major ones overseas, the Parliament Building in Dhaka and the Institute of Management in India.
How many buildings do you think he's done?
I know exactly that he completed something like 80 structures, but some of them were partial remodels of something else. And, you know, that's out of 160 commissions or something.
And he didn't care very much about houses. I mean, people would want him to do a home for them, and he would put that on to someone else. But I laughed so hard because he didn't care about food.
He didn't care about food, but he did care about houses. He did 9 houses. And of those, some of them he shifted the remodel onto someone else, but he designed those 9 houses. And there's quite a good book about the houses, actually.
However, the kitchens were small.
The kitchens were not good.
Because he didn't care about food.
There's one exceptional kitchen, two exceptional kitchens. And in each case, in one case, the client had a lot to do with it. And in the other case, he was co-designing with an artist who had a lot to do with
it. That interested me, for he is a truly sensual man.
Yes. And remember when he goes to India and he meets Henry Wilcox for the first time, and he knocks on his door, hotel room, and he says, My wife usually fills my gin flask, but it's empty. Do you have any gin?
Yes, I do. Read us a little bit more, please.
Okay. Here is from toward the end of the book. And here I'm trying to explain to myself and the reader why it matters that I've told all these details about his personal life. In other words, why is this not just a book about what a great architect he was? Why do we need to know that he had these love affairs and that they produced these children and that he was such a sensual man? What does that have to do with the architecture? So here's a passage that kind of talks about that. What Lou's architecture recognizes, and what it took from his own physical sense of himself, is the fact that we are all bodies moving through space, viscerally sensing ourselves as individuals in relation to that space. Louis Kahn, you might say, inhabited his own body more viscerally than most, and perhaps that gave him special access to the way buildings could respond to the human body at rest and particularly in motion. This awareness of the body in motion is something that transmits itself to you whenever you enter a structure he designed. It is there from the very first moment when you go into the building and discover a space you could not have imagined from the outside, and it is there as you move around from room to room, from floor to floor, always coming upon new enticements of light, shape, and texture that lead you further in. It is there most of all in your own sense of yourself as being tenderly enclosed, or borne upward, or crowned with grandeur, all in the context of a weighty structure whose mast exists not to intimidate the human-sized body, but to offer it protection and reassurance. Vincent Scully, the great architecture critic who was a big supporter of Lou's, highlighted the connection between Lou's own physical nature and the buildings he designed in a compelling description he gave of the man himself. The other thing about Kahn that one felt right away was the vitality, the love of life that came out of him, Scully remarked. He had a kind of physical generosity. He gave off life. He was a wrestler, you know, a very muscular person who walked on the balls of his feet. His hands were very big, fleshy, strong, and he gave off a sense of power. Scully knew of a woman who had once spotted Lou in New Haven and had followed him down the street because he looked so vital, so strange, so alive, so full of life in contrast to the death of most things and people. And this quality, insisted Scully, was intimately connected to his work. This is Scully now. Kahn had that, and he gave it in his buildings. This was one of the greatest things about him, to make people realize that the arts, the physical arts, are physical. They are experienced in physical, empathetic ways. That's why I dislike the things that are written about Kahn that are all cerebral, philosophical, sociological. He was physical. Lou had the physical perception of form, and that is what made him a great architect.
And that is the voice of Wendy Lesser. The book is You Say to Brick, and she is the winner of the Marfield Prize given by the DC Arts Club. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witterbinner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Additional support from the Sinipid Fund. You can download The Poet and the Poem free now on iTunes. First time for poetry. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.